We have with us live in the studios this morning, Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, very good. Starting out our news with national and environmental news this week.
Yeah, this week the EPA announced that they would draft a rule to regulate carbon emissions. This is the first step by the Obama administration to follow up on some major court rulings that have happened. Last week, I know we discussed that the EPA had been subject to a lawsuit in court. And we've talked about this on the air before, how the judicial branch of the government has been moving out ahead of the legislative branch and the executive branch on environmental regulation because the executive branch, formerly under the Bush administration, had decided to toss out the rule book when it came to environmental regulation. And the legislative branch has been worried more about getting reelected to office than anything.
Like supporting enforcement of laws, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and then this week, again, the EPA was ordered by a federal appeals board to reconsider an air permit it had issued for a coal-fired power plant that would be under construction on the Navajo Reservation. So it's like that was the last straw. And now, finally, the Obama administration has decided that, they ought to do something more than health care reform. And the EPA perked up and said, oh, yes, there's a job we have to do, and that means drafting rules to regulate carbon emissions. That means that some 400 power plants, new ones, that is, and ones that are going to be renovated in the near future, will have to definitely reduce their emissions. This rule will apply to the largest facilities that emit more than 25,000 tons of carbon dioxide per year. And I just want to also remind people that unlike what we usually hear in the mainstream media, the utilities and large industries make up about 70% of U.S. global warming emissions. That's something that we've not done anything as a nation to regulate in the past, and it's something that has to be done. And I know that last week we talked about how environmental groups won the right to sue major power companies for creating a public nuisance by not curtailing their CO2 emissions. Clearly now those companies are turning to the federal government and saying, help, put some regulations in place so that we don't have to deal with these lawsuits anymore. What I want to also talk about, too, is that two senators have introduced a bill in the Senate, finally, to do the same thing as the EPA rule would do. The difference is, of course, if Congress passes legislation, there will be something in writing that won't change from administration to administration as executive branch rules tend to do. So that's why environmental groups have been pushing for Congress to do something, and now the Senate is finally getting on the bandwagon. The House has already passed an energy bill. Of course, the House bill would put in place a cap-and-trade system. The Senate bill would do the same. I want to also point out, too, that the cap-and-trade system is a gimme to big business.
It's a shell game.
Yeah, it really is. It will allow businesses in the Western Hemisphere and Europe and so forth based here to continue to pollute and basically do it by purchasing credits from underdeveloped nations to do so.
A couple other points on that. The bill was several years in the making, which tells you the kind of sense of urgency with which Congress is treating this issue, or lack thereof.
Right.
Also, it's being introduced by Barbara Boxer and John Kerry, which, love them. They are two of the most liberal members of the Senate. They are probably two of the members who are least likely to be able to win over and assemble a coalition of 49 additional votes to get the thing passed. And then the Obama administration let slip for the first time what has been obvious to many observers. There's a really important meeting coming up in Copenhagen in the beginning of December. Actually, I believe it starts on November 30th. That is basically the run-up to negotiations for replacing the Kyoto Protocol, which, of course, the United States never ratified. The Obama administration has been very anxious to portray itself to the world as taking its rightful place as a leader on climate change policy. Of course, the rest of the world would be thrilled if the United States just sort of got with the program and became a follower. They don't even want us to become a leader because, well, they've seen what a bang-up job we've done in that role. But the Obama administration let slip this week that, well, no, actually, we're not going to have anything to show for it by the time of the meeting at the end of November, because there's no way anything can get through Congress in that kind of a time frame. So, once again, we're probably probably looking at sometime next year. It'll be an election year. There'll be a lot of special interest money coming into Congress. It's going to be a struggle.
Yeah, and that's another reason why the EPA announced their rule is because the Obama administration has given up on seeing anything out of Congress before Copenhagen. I also want to say that the rule and the bill introduced in Senate would set the target at 2005 carbon emission levels at 20%. Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. We want to get under that 2005 level by 2015, I think, and then we want to get 83% under that level by 2020. I just want to remind people too that carbon emissions were at their historic high in 2005 during the boom years of the economy, and that that's setting the bar way high. That's setting the limit way high. It should be set far lower. The Kyoto Treaty was talking about limits set at like 1990 levels. If we go into Copenhagen proposing we raise that limit up to 2005 levels, that's a failure right there in terms of the environment.
Yeah, and it's a failure that we can ill afford to have.
All right, and on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the FDIC is in trouble. This week, the FDIC had taken over three more banks, putting the total this year at about 98 bank failures for the entire year. Last year, we had something like 25 bank failures, and the year before that, it was three. The FDIC is in the red this week, meaning they need money, and there's two ways they can get more. They can either borrow it from the U.S. Treasury, which would look like a taxpayer bailout, and it would be a taxpayer bailout, or they can get it from banks through a special assessment. Banks already pay about 12 to 16 cents per every $100 in deposits to support the FDIC fund. They got an increased assessment last May, but the FDIC needs more money now, and they don't want to put an additional burden on banks. So what Sheila Bair did was she said, hey, why don't you guys prepay your assessments through 2012? In other words, she took an interest-free loan from banks. The question is, raising $45 billion in this way, is that going to be enough to last for the next 3 years? And I think the answer to that question is absolutely not. It is not enough to last for the next 3 years. The FDIC spent $20 billion last year when 25 banks failed, and they've spent $30 billion this year over 100 bank failures. And their own estimate is that they will spend a total of $100 billion through the end of next year. I think that's low, on the low end. They've already revised it up from an estimate earlier this year of $70 billion for the whole economic recession that we're going through. I think that's going to go higher.
All right. We just wrapped up national. The IMF weighing in this week with...
With their estimate of what the global economy will do in the next year or two. Once again, we got more happy talk. The IMF said that the U.S. economy, I'm just looking at the U.S. economy, they said the U.S. economy will contract 2.7% for all of 2009, and then it will expand by 1.5%, a very tiny increase by the past decade's standards. But what signs and portents did they use to predict this optimistic reversal? The IMF said...
Eye of Newt, lizard's toe.
Yes.
Electric jellyfish.
Yeah, who knows? They said, quote, gradually stabilizing retail sales, returning consumer confidence, and a firmer housing market would contribute to the reversal of fortune for the U.S. economy.
Say that again?
Yeah, gradually stabilizing retail sales, returning consumer confidence, and firmer housing markets. Clearly, they were looking in some kind of crystal ball and probably not seeing
very
much.
I want some of what they're smoking.
Yeah, I looked at that. I said, huh? You know, I think they must have been looking at the statistics for Asia, because here, the housing market, all the growth in the housing market, which is what really has been underpinning any kind of happy talk here in the U.S., that growth is all in sales of low-end properties, so the property that's priced at the lowest end of the market. People looking for bargains, people who are buying their first house, those folks who are taking advantage of the $8,000 first-time home buyer credit, people who are picking up foreclosure sales, that's what's really been underpinning the slight increase in sales this summer. It's a lot of it can be, you can argue that it was seasonal, because sales always go up in August. And as an indication that that's not going to be a long-term thing, prices are still continuing to fall in most markets.
And not to mention that the housing market is still weak with tighter credit limitations, that's often all people can afford in terms of a down payment.
Yeah. People are finding it harder to get a mortgage and a lot harder to scrape together that down payment that's now a requirement for you to buy a house.
All right. Moving on from there to the situation in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there were some major developments this week in Afghanistan. Well, for one thing, General McChrystal has submitted his request to the Pentagon for more troops. It's kind of the worst-kept secret in Washington, D.C. It hasn't been made public, but everybody knows he's asking for something along the lines of about 40,000 more troops for Afghanistan. That set off some soul-searching in Washington, D.C. this week. The big news in D.C. is, what will Obama do? Will he scrape together the 40,000 troops? No one's quite sure where he's going to get more troops for Afghanistan, considering that the military is in a state of almost near collapse. Because we heard that last week. If you went to go see Dar Jamail talk about his newest book, he has a lot of interviews in his book with folks in the military who are struggling with continuous deployment to either Iraq or Afghanistan. He talked about the Stop Loss program. He talked about record rates of PTSD and sexual assault in the military, and the fact that the military is now recruiting felons and people with a record to send over to Iraq and Afghanistan. They have reduced their standards for recruitment dramatically just to do current deployment levels, much less scrape together an additional 40,000. So really, people in the U.S. government split into two camps right now over what to do about Afghanistan. There are the hawks that want to send more troops over there and do in Afghanistan what we've done in Iraq, which is the surge. And then as part of the surge, what's also involved is sending people over there to look for and find members of the opposition to arm and train to turn against the Taliban. So folks in that camp include Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, Richard Holbrooke, who is the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Admiral Mike Mullen, who's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who is a holdover from the Bush administration. He was Defense Secretary under George Bush. Those guys want to do in Afghanistan what Bush did in Iraq. And then there are, on the other side, the lesser hawks, because there really are no doves in this discussion. There are the
lesser. Except for the 54% of the American public who want us out of Afghanistan.
Who want us to leave Afghanistan and Iraq entirely, yeah. The lesser hawks include people like Colin Powell, Senators John Kerry and Jack Reed, and Vice President Joe Biden. They also include General James L. Jones, who is Obama's national security advisor, and Rahm Emanuel, who is his chief of staff. They want fewer troops in Afghanistan. They want to concentrate on a counterinsurgency program only, that is using targeted drone strikes, missile strikes, etc., and special operations forces to go after the Al-Qaeda. Oh, I want to point out, too, that Al-Qaeda has largely been defanged. That's the estimate of intelligence agencies that came out this week. Al-Qaeda has been defanged, which means that the real enemy in Afghanistan is not Al-Qaeda.
The Taliban. And to the extent that Al-Qaeda does exist, it's not in Afghanistan.
No, it's not in Afghanistan. It's in Pakistan. It's in Africa. But it's not in Afghanistan anymore. It's just too disruptive with a war going on for them to get anything done in terms of terrorist attacks. But no, the enemy in Afghanistan is the Taliban. And we're there propping up a narco dictator, literally a dictator. We told him this week we don't care what the actual outcome of the elections are in Afghanistan. 25% fraud, you know, and ballot boxes and polling stations that didn't exist. You stuff ballot boxes. We don't care. You're our guy in Afghanistan. We're going to prop you up regardless of what the outcome of the election is. And we're doing that because we don't want the Taliban to come into power. So that's got people in Washington, D.C. scratching their heads saying, is it worth it?
All right. Anything else on that? Or moving on to the Obama administration and human...
I- I do want to talk about one more development, too, in the Afghanistan thing, too. In order to prop up the government and to tell Karzai that we support him, we have clamped down on any discussion of fraud in the elections. And as part of that, the U.S. gave the okay to the U.N. to fire the deputy U.N. commissioner in Afghanistan, Peter Galbraith, because Galbraith pointed out that Karzai was rigging the election while it was happening. And he tried to stop it, but his boss, the UN commissioner in Afghanistan, told him to shut up and sent him back home to the U.S. And now, finally, this week, he has been officially fired because he won't stop talking about the amount of fraud and the fact that the UN turned a blind eye to it.
Unlike the U.S. media, which has been all too happy to stop talking about the alleged fraud in the Afghan election and never really talked about it that much to begin with.
Yeah, the Galbraith thing you can find in the British press. You don't find it in the U.S. press.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting is Galbraith talked about the things that the New York Times found were true when they reviewed the results of the Afghan elections. The New York Times said they thought there were levels of about 25% fraud in particularly in areas that were supportive of Karzai, that they also found the reason there was such a high level of fraud is that there were non-existent polling stations, phony polling stations set up to report results, and that's what Galbraith was hammering really hard about.
All right. Moving on to the Human Rights Report this week.
Well, actually, there was no Human Rights Report this week. And no, that's not exactly true. It has been written, but it hasn't been released. We're talking, of course,
about... Doesn't that sound like things that would go on under the Bush administration?
You know, now that's change I can believe in.
the new boss,
yes,
same as the old boss.
Exactly. Never mind. Because it probably will. Anyway, the UN Human Rights Council was due to release a report this week on Israel's war on, war on the Gaza Strip earlier this year and the human rights atrocities that were carried out under that name. They were supposed to release that report this week, but the Obama administration successfully pushed to have the report shelved. At this point, it will not be released. The report, among other things, recommends that unless both Palestine and Israel investigate the malfeasances that occurred during that war, and you know in Israel's case it's not going to happen because they brag about it. They thought it's perfectly wonderful that the International Criminal Court should consider war crimes prosecutions, particularly against Israel. That is an explosive recommendation, and the Obama administration, out of the best interest of Palestinians, because, of course, we don't want to derail the peace process. Of course, you can't derail a dry-docked peace process, but, pushed really, really hard, and the United Nations shelved the report this week. So, once again, something very similar to what we would have seen under the Bush administration.
All right, and very briefly, Iran.
Yeah, not a whole lot to report this week because sanctions are going to be, or stricter sanctions against Iran are going to be considered in the next few days. The United States pushing and lobbying very hard with the West and with allies in light of the report that we talked about last week of a new nuclear facility, which actually technically isn't in violation of any laws because it hasn't come online yet. Iran reported it to the IAEA in a timely manner, but none of that has stopped the U.S. media and the Obama administration from making hay that it's somehow a secret plant. If it's secret, how come we know about it?
And have known about it for months, if not years.
Yeah, it is a remarkably orchestrated campaign by the Obama administration and its enablers in the U.S. media to essentially run this country up to the idea of paving the way for more aggressive actions against Iran other than simply sanctions. And we're talking, of course, about the desire by some for a military strike by either Israel or the United States. And again, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
All right. Events?
One event to speak of this coming week is the 8th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan. We've always been in war in Eurasia. We'll always be at war with Eurasia. So October 7th, which I believe is Wednesday, is that correct? No. I don't have a calendar in front of me.
Nor do I.
But But October 7th is the anniversary date at 4 p.m. on that day. It is Wednesday, as I think about it. Folks will be meeting and protesting at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle. So 4 o'clock, October 7th, anniversary, war in Afghanistan. Be there.
This coming Wednesday. All right.
Yes.
Talking with Job Parrish, Maria Tomchick with Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
It's a free publication. It comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it wherever you get free publications, bookstores, coffee houses, King County Library System, and so forth. So anyway, you can do that, or you can find Eat the State online at www.eatthestate.org.